The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. So I want to wish you all a happy Vaisak. This is the big one in our calendar. According to some of the Buddhist world, today is the start of 2560. Somebody told me they looked at it on the internet, and somebody else said 2559, but that's just fine. What's a year? What's 2 years? It's a lot of years. In our formal meal verse that we say when we have our formal meals during retreats, we start by reciting, "The Lord Buddha was born in Kapilavastu, enlightened in Magadha, taught in Varanasi, died in Kushinagara." Okay, so that's the place he was born, the place he was enlightened, the place he taught, and the place he died. And these are considered to be the essential holy sites of the Buddha. It's recorded that the Buddha said, in fact, people should visit these sites after he died. Well, at the end of last December, through the generosity of someone, I went on a 3-week pilgrimage to northern India. So I went to these places. We visited where the Buddha was born. That's actually called Lumbini nowadays. It's in Nepal, over the border from India. We visited where he was enlightened, in Bodh Gaya, okay, and where he first taught the five ascetics. In those days, it was seems to have been called Benares. Now it's called Varanasi. Varanasi, Benares, is actually the oldest inhabited city in the world. So you get some perspective on history in India. And of course, we visited where the Buddha died, Kushinagara. I also visited Sankisa, Kosambi, Sarnath, Shravasti, Vaisali, Nalanda, Rajgir, and many places in between. And this was all in 21 days. Okay, so it was a bit of a whirlwind pilgrimage. You know, I mean, you could spend lots of time at each of these places, but I was very grateful to have the time I had. And, you know, 21 days is a good amount of time. Actually, without looking back at my journal, which I kept while I was going, because people give me blank books, and it seemed, well, this is a good use of a blank book. it's kind of helpful because you get very confused after a while. The holy sites in India, in northern India that I visited, many of them are these beautiful parks. Okay, most of them have remains of a stupa on them. Sometimes it's the Buddha's relics. Sometimes it's one of the Buddha's disciples. There's one to the Monkey King who offered honey to the Buddha. Sujata, the person who gave Buddha the meal after he decided to denounce asceticism. Anyway, there's usually a stupa, and there's usually the brick remains of foundations of temples and monasteries, because what happened is, well, there were stupas made, and then monasteries started to spring up around the stupas. And, you know, 2,500 years plus, what's left is actually bricks, brick foundation. The brick is the basic building unit of India to this day. You see bricks, piles of bricks, brick buildings, brick kilns everywhere. Okay? And it was back then. And, you know, the foundations are really intact. But what was above has got knocked off. As I understand it, too, quite a number of these places, the jungle took over in time. You know, events in history caused Buddhism to be sort of snuffed out in places, in a number of these places. So the jungle grew over these, and then, you know, quite a bit of time later, they were rediscovered. And especially in the last 100 years have they been rediscovered. Most of the holy sites have lots of people. India is lots of people. You know, most places, but there's lots of people at the holy sites. People chanting in Pali, in Chinese, probably in different languages, but definitely I could pick up on those. People bowing, people throwing prayer scarves, people praying, and there's also lots of children, lots of school children. Okay, and the Indian school children wear these uniforms, very, very nice. But the young children would play in the old brick foundations, which, you know, I thought was fantastic. And although it was noisy, you know, have children running around, laughing, and you know, they were having a great time. And I thought, you know, what a way to spend part of your youth. I would have loved it. I actually spent part of my youth climbing on some stones that ended up being part of the Cistercian monastery down below us. It's a long story. They belonged to the Hearsts, and they got dumped in Golden Gate Park. And so we as kids played all around them. But a wonderful thing for these kids. There were not a lot of signs and information around the holy sites. Okay, I gleaned a bit from books and that I was given, actually a really good book on the holy sites of northern India. Years ago, I heard someone tell a story about they went to India, okay, and they went to one of the holy sites, and they circumambulated the stupa, thinking that it was the stupa they were supposed to circumambulate. Well, it turned out it wasn't. I don't know who the stupa was, but you know, you can end up thinking you're going to a Buddhist place and go to a Hindu temple by accident. It just happens. But anyway, what this person did is they did the circumambulation with sincerity, they did it with dignity and faith. So even though that it was supposedly the wrong stupa, did it really matter? Okay. I think I probably myself, in my trip to India, did the same thing. I mean, it just sometimes you didn't know what something was, and you just venerated it. I mean, not in some strange way, but just, you know, it's possible that the relics of the Buddha are there. Okay. So I don't want to give you a blow-by-blow account of my pilgrimage, because I probably bore the heck out of you. But I thought I'd tell you some things about it and some of the holy sites that I went to, because I found it interesting. There were some very humorous things that happened, very human things that happened, and for me at least, some very profound things that happened at some of the holy sites. So let me try to tell you about them. So first off, we flew into Delhi in India. It's a very long flight, okay? And I spent a lot of the time on the airplane strolling up and down the aisles and stretching in the back of the plane. I have a propensity to get blood clots. So just have to be careful. And that was fine, but you know how it is. After a really long plane trip, you get off, and you just don't quite know where you are, and you're pretty wrung out. Well, when we got to the airport in Delhi, got out of the plane, somehow we walked right out of the place our baggage was into the public area. We didn't get our baggage. Okay. First thing in India, we leave our baggage. So we tried to get back in, and of course, it doesn't fly very well. There's these two guards there. Now, fortunately, our tour guide appeared, and he, of course, could speak the language, knows the customs, knows the right things to say, and so then I was allowed to go back in and get the luggage for both of us. There's two of us on this trip. You know, the question was, would I remember the descriptions of our luggage at this point in time. Well, I did. I found them. So that was all taken care of. But it took about 45 minutes. Okay, so when you visit the holy sites in India, we didn't, and I don't think most people do. You don't visit them in some kind of chronological order from the Buddha's birth to his death. You know, you fly into Delhi, and then you go somewhere. You fly into Bodh Gaya. Actually, it's Gaya where you fly into. And you just start where you start. So I kind of went up all over the place, which, of course, added to my confusion sometimes where exactly where I was or where I had been. And he just basically traveled to the closest place to you. Mind you, that was sometimes 7 or 8 hours. So the first place we visited, first holy site, is called Sankisa. And Sankisa is where the Buddha, he often stayed there for his rains retreats. A number of these holy sites were things like that, places that the Buddha stayed for his rains retreat. And it's also the place that he is said to have descended from the Tushita heaven after giving teaching to his mother, Mayamaya, is that right? Okay, yeah. So Sankisa is way out in the country. And there's not really any explanation of anything. You know, there was this hill you went up on, and everybody was going up there and reciting scriptures and sitting. And so we did that, and then there was a shrine. There was one of Asoka's pillars, remainder of one of those. So, you know, it's all very interesting, but there wasn't a lot of information, a lot of explanation. I don't know that there needs to be. Also, with the holy sites in India, many of them are being excavated. You know, they're digging because they're finding all kinds of new things all the time. Okay. And as I said, you know, up to maybe 100 years ago, many of these were completely overgrown and deserted. So they've been refound. Okay. The people of India are much more mobile now, so there's a lot of Indians that go to these places. And, of course, Buddhist tourists from all over the world come, not just Asian countries, but from the West and from Europe. And also there were lots of temples around Sankisa. So kind of what did happen long ago, thousands of years ago, is happening now. So you got the re-excavating of a holy site, and then all of a sudden monasteries start to spring up all in that country. This is wonderful. There was a Cambodian temple in the process of being built. So bricks and cement. Really, you know, really beautiful, but you know, somewhat in the early stages of building. The interesting thing was that when you went inside the building, which they let us do, the Buddha image was on the half-built altar. It was already sitting there. I thought, how fantastic. I hope it doesn't get hit with anything, but it was really nice to see. So next we headed to Kasambi. Long trip again. We're on the highway for a while, great roads, and then we turn off the highway. And the roads get worse and worse and worse. I mean, they're worse than the road used to be to Phugan Hermitage. For those of you who know Phugan Hermitage. I mean, they were bad, okay? According to the people, the government wouldn't give them money to work on the road. And then, often in India, on the roads, you go through villages. Villages are right on the side of roads, or at least part of them. So through these bad roads, we kept going through village by village, you know, village and village. We're just going further into these smaller villages. And the road is getting worse and worse. At one point, there's a tractor in the middle of the road, and the road is really narrow, and the wheel's off the tractor. So we can't get around the tractor. So what we did is we got out and we walked. And we walked to what we thought was Kosambi, but actually we ended up at a Jain temple. Because it turned out there's two Kosambis. So, okay. And bless our driver, for another hour or more, he drove to find the Kosambi that we wanted to go to. And we found it at twilight. And we walked around for 45 minutes. You couldn't see much, but yeah, it was interesting. Okay. Right. So our next visit was to Srivasti and the ruins of Jetavana Monastery. I'm sure a number of you know that word. It's very famous. Sudatta was the donor of the Jetavana Monastery. The land was owned by Jetta. And it's said what Sudatta had to do to be able to buy that was he had to lay gold coins on the ground, everywhere on the land, so he could purchase it for the Buddha. And he does. He ends up getting it. And Jetta is not, he's a bit tight, you know. And he's gonna, they need lumber for the buildings, and he's going to sell that to, I don't know, Sudatta or something. But anyway, he ends up giving it to the monks. And so it becomes Jetavana Monastery. An interesting story about Sudatta is Sudatta heard about the Buddha and was very interested and thought about becoming his disciple. But he was caught in a dilemma. And he asked the Buddha whether he could become a follower of the Buddha without giving up worldly life. So in other words, did he have to become a monk? And to his question, the Buddha replied that it is enough that he followed his vocation in a righteous manner. So it was fine that he remained a layperson. You know, the crux of the matter was to do the practice. Okay. So, another interesting thing about Jetavana Monastery is apparently it was active to the 11th or 12th century. That's AD, you know. So that's like 15 centuries. What if Shasta Abbey is here for 15 centuries? You know, we haven't even hit half of one yet. But I don't know. We don't know. We don't know what will happen. You know, we'll just do our best. You all will do your best. And as we all know, you do your best and impermanence sets in. Okay? So things change. The interesting thing in the Jetavana Monastery, there's an old Bodhi tree in the monastery. And if I got this correct, it comes from a cutting of a Bodhi tree in Sri Lanka, which actually came from a cutting from the original Bodhi tree. So, and this is true of many of the holy sites. There's a Bodhi tree, and somehow they're all tied in, you know, so the story goes. But I think it's a wonderful teaching on impermanence and interconnectedness, and how things are passed on. You know, one thing dies, but things can be passed on. You know, death isn't the end of everything. Okay. Trying to not make this so long, so I'm not going to probably say everything I wanted to say. Oh, we also, in Srivasti, we visited a temple. I heard about this from Annie Calden, Reverend Bernice. She had met a Korean monk who ran a temple that was dedicated to the Diamond Sutra. So, you know, somehow we found it. You know, I don't think by accident, I think we drove into the place it was. And they have a 33-ton statue of the Buddha teaching the Diamond Sutra. It's an outdoor statue, obviously. Okay. But we had an opportunity to meet this Korean monk who's been in India now a number of years. He spoke a little bit of English. He's really kind. Really, really, you know, sweet face. Really, really kind. And we had some tea with him. We exchanged thoughts a bit. And we asked if we could see his meditation hall, I guess. I think that's what we asked him about. And it turned out that it was up on the second floor. We go up there, and the Diamond Sutra is behind the altar, okay, written out in, I don't know, Pali something. And he had somebody come up. He had one of somebody from his temple come up when we were there and start reciting the Diamond Sutra while we sat there. It was really sweet. Okay. All right. So, kind of next, we traveled into Nepal. So Nepal is where Lumbini is, where the Buddha was born. The thing is, we almost didn't get into Nepal. The person that I was with had an older passport than I did for getting into Nepal. And what the Indian border people said is that he could go to Nepal, but he had to stay there for 2 months before he could get back into India. And of course, Nepal was not the last place on our journey, so you know we didn't want to do this. So there was a lot of posturing and going back and forth in offices, and grunting, and this is the usual stuff. And then, you know, some money was produced, and we were off to Nepal. You know, it may have all been fine, and but sometimes money can help. Okay, so we get into Nepal, and Lumbini, where the Buddha was born in Nepal, is an enormous park. So all these holy sites are like parks, green grass, water, just beautiful. And as I said, you got the holy site, and then eventually, in the ruins, and eventually around that springs up new Buddhist monasteries, temples, which is lovely. And Lumbini was the biggest park, I think, that I saw, the biggest ground of a holy site. So we had to get from where we were in the parking lot to the other end of Lumbini, something of like a half a mile or a mile, I'm not sure. We didn't have much time. So we end up taking a rickshaw, a bicycle-driven rickshaw, and there's two of us on the rickshaw, and it's being driven by this man that's older than me, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm really embarrassed. And I had to think, okay, this is how he makes a living, you know. And he seemed to do it very cheerfully and not strain or anything. So we had a rickshaw ride to most of the way to the birth site of the Buddha. The birth site of the Buddha is in a covered area. There's a lot of security around it. And you parade through it, and you can see the spot where the Buddha was born. A number of years ago, a plaque was found in the ground, because they're still digging this place out, where the Buddha was supposedly born, you know, on that spot. So that's quite moving. And lots of people just parading through. Lots of children who are having a really heck of a time keeping quiet in this place you're supposed to keep really quiet, you know. It was really impressive. Yeah, there's this road that you take to the site where the Buddha was born. There's a road on each side, and in the middle is a reflecting pool that just goes on and on. Really beautiful. And then on either side of the road are monasteries. On one side is Theravadin, on one side is Mahayana. Okay, and we went there twice, and one of the times that I came out of where the area where the Buddha was born, there was this tall Australian monk prancing towards me. He's a Tibetan monk, very very nice. He thought he'd met me somewhere before. I have this happen to me a lot, where people think they've met me. I haven't been there. Anyway, he was very nice, and he was staying in a Tibetan monastery that was funded from Austria. So the thought came to my mind, what if someday there's a monastery there donated by Americans? I don't know. It could happen. I mean, we're all this is very young. This resurgence is very young. I don't know that I'd wish that on anybody. It's a hard monastery life when people are coming in constantly. You know, I think I noticed very smartly the monasteries would close down on certain hours, and also you could only get in so far. Okay. So next we travel to Kushinagara. This is, of course, where the Buddha died, where he had his Mahaparinirvana. And it's also where he was cremated, and then his remains scattered all over India and then scattered all over the world, and now returning to India, some of his remains returning and going in stupas and shrines that various countries are putting up. There's a temple that enshrines a 24-foot-long reclining Buddha. That's the main temple in this site. And you can sit in there, and of course you can circumambulate around it, and people chant. And so we sat there for quite a long time. The Buddha is actually made out of a black stone. Okay, it was something that had been buried years ago, and it was dug up. I think if I'm getting that correct. But it's black stone, but actually it's gold, because people come and they put gold leaf on it. And they put these huge pieces of cloth on it. That's a just very common thing for people to do, is put this enormous piece of cloth over the Buddha, like a blanket, not over his head. Okay. But it's a very powerful place to sit and contemplate the Buddha and the fact of the Buddha's death here. I have here that it sank into oblivion in the 7th century AD. So, and then it was refound in the 20th century, early 20th century, it was refound, rediscovered. Yeah. And as at the other holy sites, there's all kinds of Buddhist temples around this holy site. We met a monk at the Vietnamese temple. Very, very nice. Perfect English. He was raised in Orange County. Okay. So our next stop was at Vaisali. This is a really interesting place, okay, because Vaisali is where the Buddha finally allowed women to join the monastic Sangha. You know, his stepmother pleaded with him, and then Ananda pleaded with him. But finally, and I gather it was in the area of Vaisali. And interestingly, at Vaisali, there's this, it's called a swastika-shaped monastery. And what it said on the sign was that this was a female monastery. And that's the only one I saw, at least the only one that the signage gave you the information about, of all the holy sites. This one, so I really liked it, and I circumambulated it, and we actually were there in the morning, and we came back in the afternoon, and I did the same thing. The person that I went with, he liked to meditate and was meditating in the park somewhere. Okay, so in the morning we had met these kids in the garden. There's always a lot of children, and these children were baking. That's not uncommon at some of the holy sites. But they were begging. They wanted rupees or chocolate or cookies. Didn't really have any of them. And when they saw me that afternoon, they just stuck to me like glue. Okay, so I had these 12 children and a dog following me around the perimeter of Vaisali. And you know, it was okay. You know, one of the kids spoke a bit of English, and I told him I wasn't going to give him any rupees. Because partly what happens is you start doing that and it doesn't end. I mean, people just come from everywhere around you. And I didn't have any cookies. And so we're walking around the perimeter, and I realize I'm not going to be able to shake these kids. You know, they're kind of with me. The only way that I can do it is leave the grounds, and I didn't want to do that. So I came up with a bright idea, sort of. I decided, well, I'll find my friend who's meditating, and I'll go sit there with him, because that's what I was intending to do anyway. And surely the kids, you know, they'll just go away. They'll just go away. Well, they didn't go away when we got to the place. There was like a dozen. And actually, there were more kids joining on. I was like the Pied Piper. And I don't know, we were up to 16 or 20 kids at one point. And I sat down, and they sort of sat down. But, you know, they're kids. They're fidgeting. They're goofing around. So I decided, well, okay, I'm going to lay some ground rules here. And the one of the boys who seemed to understand a bit of English, I said, you can stay here and you can sit here, but you have to be quiet. And I showed him the meditation posture. Okay. So we had about 16, 18 kids, I don't know, maybe it was 20 in the end, sitting there in meditation. And then we had all these adults who were coming and looking at this site. Very interesting. Well, of course, after about 10 minutes, the youngest of them, they started fidgeting and goofing around again. Could you expect any different? You know, and there was one of the older kids kind of wanted to be an enforcer because I think he was convinced that if they stayed long enough, they would all get rupees. It wasn't going to happen. So I told him, don't do that. You know, and the kids, the younger kids ran off. And but a few of the older kids, they didn't budge. Okay? And they stayed with us until we walked out the gate. Well, I mean, who knows what karmic effect that will have for their life. You know? Just don't know. I want to say that with the swastika monastery, too, I circumambulated that, and I thought of Reverend Master Jiyu, my teacher. And I thought of Reverend Master Mayon and the monks at the abbey. Something about that place. Okay. Okay. How did I get? Where am I now? Did all that? Okay. Okay. So there's just a few more stops left. Actually, two that I'll talk about. So the next place we went was Rajgir. Well, Rajgir is where Vulture Peak is, right outside. Vulture Peak is where the Buddha gave a number of his discourses, a number of his talks. In the Mahayana world, some people feel that that's where he gave the Prajnaparamita teachings. So that's the Heart Sutra would be part of that. And when I climbed to the top of that, it was a really good climb you had to go up. And I was able to recite the scripture of great wisdom up there. I did very quietly into myself because most of what you could hear was Pali chanting going on. But there actually were some Westerners up there who were reciting the scripture of great wisdom too. And on the way up to Vulture Peak, there are caves that the Buddha meditated in. And you can go in these caves and you can meditate. You don't want to stay there too long because there's other people that want to go in there, at least this time of year. But that was really something. Okay, my last stop, hope I'm not boring the heck out of you here, was in Bodh Gaya. Our last stop was in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was awakened. And you talk about holy sites and people. Well, Bodh Gaya was packed. Just thousands upon thousands of people. There was a Tibetan world peace ceremony going on in the holy ground site. And so there was just seas of Tibetans, you know, just coming and going. And you can get in. You can no longer actually get right up to the Bodhi tree because in 2013, a bomb went off in Bodh Gaya. Well, that's our modern world. Fortunately, it went off at 4:30 in the morning. And so I don't think there were any people injured or just a few. Of course, that's not so good even that. But it was fortunate it didn't go off in, you know, 4 in the afternoon or something. So to get into the Mahabodhi Temple, which is where the Bodhi tree is right outside of, and there's a big statue of the Buddha sitting in earth witness posture, you have to go through metal detectors and you're frisked. You know, it's the way it is. And thousands of people, I mean thousands of people, but somehow the beautiful thing was, even with all those people, we didn't seem to be colliding into each other because we had to, you know, go through each other and cross over. People were very polite. And there was all kinds of chanting going on. But I found in sitting on the ledge that's outside of the circles of Mahabodhi Temple and the Bodhi tree, there's a ledge where you can sit for those of us who can't sit on the ground anymore very well. And I could sit there and it was okay. You know, there's all this chanting going on in the background, but there was a quiet, there was a peace there. It was, you know, kind of unexplainable, but you could just sit through it. The one time we ventured over into the meditation gardens in these grounds, okay, very quiet, but there was mosquitoes. And quite frankly, I'd rather the noise than the mosquitoes. So I went back to out in front of the Mahabodhi temple there, and I would sit. And what I would do is sit, and then I would circumambulate, and I spent a lot of time. We were 4 days in Bodh Gaya, and that was really great because you could go back there from very early in the morning till quite late at night. One time when I was sitting there, and I'm sitting on this stone ledge, and you know it's kind of cold and hard, and especially you sit for a while. And this Chinese female monk came up to me, and she presented me with a little rug, so I could sit on the rug. And I thought, oh, well, thank you. I want, you know, say, how can I give it back to you? And she, you know. She said, no, it's for you. And I was just really kind. Okay, last story. I can't resist this one. Last story. So we flew to Delhi out of Gaya. Gaya is right next to Bodh Gaya. It's actually an older city than Bodh Gaya, and in some ways bigger than Bodh Gaya. So we flew out of Gaya to Delhi. The airport building is like a temple. It looks like a Buddhist temple, you know, from the outside. And we walk in the door, and there's a big Buddha image and an incense bowl. So I'm standing there, and there's a Vietnamese monk standing right next to me. And we're given incense, and we both offer incense. And then we turn, and we look at each other, and we realize we know each other. And he says, oh yeah, you're Daishin from Shasta Abbey. He said, I've done firewood with you. That's really, really sweet. Okay. So it's a small world. Okay. I'm just going to end by saying that, you know, I think pilgrimages are good to do. I mean, this is not an opportunity that I was looking for, but it happened, and I'm really pleased that I went. I mean, there was a lot to see and learn, and you get the feeling of how old of a world religion and how universal a religion Buddhism is. Okay. I had a great companion, a person who generously donated the whole trip for me, looked out for me, a good driver, a good guide. We stayed in good hotels. It was a bit of a luxury trip, really. So anyway, I have a lot of gratitude for the whole trip. Okay, but I came back with the thought that in fact, there is no place like home. You know, they say home is where the heart is, and I think the heart is where our practice comes out from. Okay, and I think because of River Master Jiyu, we have a vibrant practice here. Okay, of the Buddha Dharma, right here in Northern California. We actually don't have to travel around the world to find the Buddha's truth. Right here, we're offered the same practice as the Buddha did, this ancient way of finding the truth. It can be helpful to visit the Buddhist wonders of the world. There are a lot of them, not just in India, but they're, you know, it can be really helpful to see them. And they're beautiful. And if you have the opportunity, I think it's wonderful. It's encouraging to read and hear teachings by great masters. Okay? No doubt. Short retreats, long retreats, private solo retreats, they can help in our practice. But, and in the beginning, in the middle, in the end, each one of us has to get in there and do the practice. Precepts, meditation, mindfulness in everyday life, kindness, compassion, equanimity, patience, you know, in Buddhism we go on and on, because there are all these ways in which we manifest practice. The key, the ticket, is that we have to do the daily practice. Okay, that's the place of it. And we do it unconditionally. Because, of course, we cannot control the conditions. We do it unconditionally. I think then you have met the Buddha face to face. Okay? Shakyamuni Buddha pointed to the Buddha in all of us. That's the wonderful thing about his teaching. You know, he wasn't up here and we're down here. He said we all have this within us. It's just a matter of us doing it. And he gave us a practice for human beings. So the key, you know, the ticket, again, is to get in there and do it. So take the opportunities you have. Thank you.